Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to begin with a really in-depth look at the newest sciences on how we can rejuvenate our bodies with a new way of resetting our clocks, our internal clocks. I'll be sharing insights from Dr. Julia Scope and Dr. Michael West and some of the cutting-edge material. I'll also be sharing my own insights of what has been my entire career in anti-aging research and therapy. My guest in the second part of our program will be Annie Jacobson. She's a top journalist. She's also an expert on war, weapons, U.S. national security, government secrecy, and military history. And we're going to talk about Operation Paperclip, its history and legacy of Americans spying on Americans, bringing in the Nazis to work in our government, and to just to show you that we've had a long history of special interest doing their work in secret. Also from our environmental today, we're going to talk about the new research from the University of Berkeley that tests the soil and finds a fantastically high cesium level on California roadside. That means that Fukushima has made a difference. Also, a special report from Yale University, as fracking booms, growing concerns about wastewater. What this means is that with hydraulic fracturing for oil and gas to the level it is today, which is massive across the United States, we should ask, what's happening with the millions of gallons of contaminated drilling fluids that are ending up in our water supply? Roger Drowen will share the latest on that. Last evening, after a long day of work, I wanted to see how the different news media were covering the crisis in the Ukraine. And both the Democrat and Republican, I might mention corporate Democrat and corporate Republican, both covered fairly much the same. And then, of course, you had the former ambassador to the UN who was harping about, you know, that we should be extreme. You had Bill O'Reilly saying that we have to get really tough, meaning military intervention. And I'm thinking, what did they miss? What are we not being told? So today, I will share with you how fascism is resurfacing in Ukraine and that both the left and the right media got it wrong. Eric Dreister from Global Research. Also from Tom Engelhart. I've been talking about fascism and why we should pay attention to it. Tom Engelhart from Tom Dispatch, Documenting Darkness, How a Thug State, that's the United States, Really Operates, and how what Snowden has done by releasing 1.7 million documents, or at least stealing that many, how many more are there that we don't know about? How about hundreds of millions that we don't have? We don't even have 0.1%. And you imagine how bad it is what we have. Imagine if we got it all. If time permits, a commentary on why do we fear the truth? And I'm talking about everybody. I'm not making any exceptions. All right, from gurus and motivational speakers and people at all spectrums of the world, I do not see universal truth. I see individual truths that people hold on to and defend and argue about. But what about a universal truth? Robert Burrows, Nation of Change, will discuss it. If time permits, an in-depth discussion of what's wrong with milk. From Dr. Robert Krajan, head of breast surgery and at Seton Medical Center, there's a lot wrong with milk that we are not aware of. We'll bring you up to date on it. As you see, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. Do you know that time and again I have suggested that before you do something, eat something, drink something, feel something, ask yourself, what is the likely outcome? Of course, we never do this. We just assume that what we're doing is right or won't have an impact, or it may have an impact, but it's temporary, and by tomorrow, it'll be fine. I can't tell you how many people I know that will not be conscious about their diet with any consistency, but then on the weekend they'll make some effort. They'll run upstate, they'll do a juice fast at one of the retreats, they'll do some yoga, they'll do some working out in the park, and they assume that if they've had their wheatgrass juice, all is well. It isn't. Every single action in our life is cumulative. This is also karmic. I recently received an email from a person who has spent their entire adult life manipulating financial transactions for the benefit of a handful of mega-rich people, but in return of finding them corporations to buy, and those corporations then downsize, fire people, take out their pensions. It is economic genocide. That's also karmic. We never escape our karma. We just think we do. We don't. And so that's also part of this idea of the energy we take in. We don't think of the consequences. If we're getting a big payout and that payout allows us to buy things, we assume, what's wrong with that? It's legal and I've increased my standard of living. Yeah, well, did you do it ethically? Did you do it morally? And then that's where we're afraid to face the truth. So I look at these problems and issues possibly from a little broader perspective, and I'm hoping that many of you are doing the same or have. And that brings me to the whole idea of why aren't we living longer lives? I know why my parents' generation didn't live long lives, because they did a lot of the things that they were encouraged to do, and they did it correctly. In fact, they were all good citizens. They never demonstrated against anything. They were confused about why I was against the war in Vietnam and thought that maybe if I came back to West Virginia, my perspectives would clear up and I'd get back to being a good citizen and not going to Columbia University campus and other places to protest. And why are you writing all those editorials, Gary? Do you realize people read them? They had a collection of them, and it embarrassed them that I would be writing things that would challenge our government, challenge our basic values, because I had grown up with good values, and indeed I had, for most of them. But one of the values I never accepted was conformity. I was never conformist. I never fit in. I still don't. I can't tell you a place I could go and feel like, you know, I'm one of them. So I just created my own reality. At times, that's a lonely reality. At times, you look around and you're fighting battles. There's no one else fighting them with you. At times, you suffer. There are consequences. It doesn't mean these are fatal consequences, but there's a sacrifice you have to make if you want to be true to your authentic self and your authentic beliefs. Easier just to compromise and get along, go along, and not hassle. Live your life through various distractions. But that doesn't work. And so when I saw everyone sitting playing canasta and having a good time and sharing the comfort of a large family, all being together on Sundays, that ceased, never happened again after the dynamic assertive in the family or the dynamic aggressive, my great uncle George Gabriel, when he died, that was it, which would later teach me something about why things happen, who causes things to happen, what happens when that person's removed. No different than when my Uncle George, where we'd all go to his house and the kids would go out and be given a quarter and go to the movies, and the adults after dinner, the adults would sit in the main room and we would sit in the kitchen and eat there, and after we did the dishes and put everything away, we'd go to the movies. They'd play canasta all day. And that's how it was my whole adult until he died. Then it never happened again, ever, because no one else was a dynamic energy to cause that to happen. Same thing with Detroit. Same thing with Rust Belt. Same thing with the destruction of economies ecologies, and communities. If you don't have the right blend of life force energies working cooperatively together and harmonizing for the best needs of all on the high end, you'll see the erosion factor. Anyhow, so I look at all this and I put it all together and I say we better have a picture that puts everything together, not just a piece. The trouble is we're always looking for the magic piece, the magic nutrient, the magic something, the magic saying, the magic book, the magic film, you know, the secret. Well, there's no secret about the secret except how stupid most people were to believe that there was somehow, by just believing that you can get something, it'll come to you. It doesn't happen. And I can show you an awful lot of people who tried very hard to believe in something, including a cure for their disease or their kid's disease, didn't happen. You have to be looking at everything, pulling it together. So when I approached the subject of aging, and I saw that all these people were dying at a young age, and they were not healthy as they aged, it was because they were living with a faulty belief system. Hence, the number one cause of death and destruction and war and famine and home foreclosures and bankruptcies and divorces is not the individual per se. It is the belief system that they have embraced. But we're afraid to make that accusation. Because it's A, too complex, and B, who would we be without our beliefs? We would be invisible. So we have to bring it back to the rapid advances in the field of stem cell therapies today. Most people are completely unaware of this. And this is where we find the elusive goal of harnessing the sense that we do not have to age and die as everyone before us has. There's a Dr. Michael West, and he is really at the cusp of this. And Dr. Julius Goep, G-O-E-P-P, who's also very much involved in anti-aging medicine, had a conversation, and we are the beneficiaries of that conversation, because what Dr. West found was that we needed a paradigm shift. And that's why we don't have cures or improvement in cancer, heart disease, arthritis, or anything else for that matter, because we don't challenge the paradigm. We only look to tweak it or bring something else new into it. So we're looking for the next chemotherapy instead of re-examining why we get cancer and how to stimulate the body's natural killer cell activity so it could fight cancer itself. We don't do anything to help the body in its efforts against disease because we don't understand it. We don't believe that the body has this innate knowledge because we haven't discovered it. But lying inside of us is something unique. And this has caused a paradigm shift for Dr. West, who led to a technique called induced pluripotent stem cells, or IPS. I'll write that down. And this has also led to human embryonic progenitor cells, or HEP, both of which allow researchers to quite effectively leapfrog over many previously existing barriers. Now, I'll tell you how serious it is. Harvard researchers announced that they had used the IPS technique of Dr. West to produce, quote, a robust new collection of disease-specific stem cell lines that hold immediate hope for advances in a host of diseases, Parkinson's, type 1 diabetes, Huntington's, Down's, and two forms of muscular dystrophy and others. Now, the recent news from Harvard researchers, it appears that we are truly poised at the threshold of an incredible new era, starting now, not in the future, where we can unlock the inner workings of our cells and virtually mass produce any cell or tissue type in the human body in a youthful state. Well, the implications of these advances are enormous. They include readily available tissue and organ transplants. Think of all the people who have liver disease and kidney disease and heart disease and aging brains. This would literally obliterate genetic disorders and end the chronic age-related diseases. In fact, it would reverse a lot of aging. We would get younger. Now, West takes a look at ancient times, and he discovered that although we as individuals age and die, our species does not. Now, amazing as this sounds, each of us is made of cells that have been proliferating since the dawn of life on Earth. And that really was the beginning of what we today seek to achieve through our gerontology and regenerative medicine. The lineage of cells produced by the reproductive system has been known as germ-like cells since the work of 19th century German scientist August Weismann. Now, Weismann recognized that germ-like cells represent a lineage of cells that has continued unbroken since life began. What's that mean in lay language? It means that these cells in our body obviously never aged, and if they did, you and I wouldn't be here. Weismann was interested in this fundamental question. Why is it that the non-germline cells in our bodies, the somatic cells, inevitably age and die on cue? Why are cells in our skin, our blood, our bones, and even our brains so reproducibly programmed to age in such a short period of time, while germ-like cells have been proliferating for billions of years? Well, this intrigued Weismann. And Weismann made an astonishing prediction in 1881. He speculated that the reason individuals age is that somatic cells, of which most of us are made, have somehow lost the capacity, still inherent in primitive single-cell creatures, like bacteria, for proliferating without limit. So restore that capability, and you could restore the cellular immortality that still is present in our germ-like cells. Now, a series of elegant and now classic experiments by biologist Leonard Hayflick in the 1950s showed, in fact, that there is a limit to how many times a human somatic cell can reproduce in vitro before they simply stop. Hayflick had discovered the existence of what amounts to a cellular clock that appears to run down after a relatively short number of generations of cell replication. Now, you've heard me talk many times about telomeres, telo, T-E-L-O, mers, M-E-R-E-S. These are cellular fuses. Now, what is the actual physical nature of the mysterious cellular clock that limits the lifespan of human somatic cells? At the time when Dr. West began his scientific career, he became convinced that this intrinsic clock of cellular aging was somehow connected with chromosomes. And he became intrigued by a little-known theory proposed in the early 1970s by a Russian scientist, and that said that repeating DNA sequences at the end of each chromosome were like a burning fuse, which acted as a clock, because every time the cell replicated this segment, called a telomere, became shorter and shorter. And when it ran out, the cellular machinery signaled a fatal error in copying the vital genetic material, which would trigger the senescence of the somatic cell. Now, the full-length repeating telomere sequence was maintained in germ-like cells, and therefore you had an immortalizing enzyme that continuously spun fresh telomere DNA, allowing germ-line cells to reproduce themselves. So, in 1986, West had read the work of biologist Howard Cook, who found that telomeres shortened with each generation in white blood cells, which are somatic cells and have finite lifespans, but maintain their length in germ-like cells, like sperm. So seeing these puzzle pieces fall into place was so convincing that West took a leave of absence from medical school to court venture capitalists and eventually started a company called Geron to build on what West still refers to as the telomere gamble. And that's where we are today. Now, let me explain this in maybe a little easier to understand way. And I'll give it by example. Two sets of rats, one downstairs, being used mainly in cancer research by the ultra-Orthodox scientists at the Institute of Applied Biology, thousands of them. They generally lived about 12 to 14 months. They were kept in small little boxes with little metal grating and a water bottle be put through and their rat pellets be put in, and that was it. Upstairs on the third floor, I was doing the anti-aging research. No cages. Beautiful music, a creative environment, personal contact with the rats. As many of you, thousands of you, over the years came in the night, and you would sit there behind the glass wall watching the experiments I was conducting, including the Psi research that I never talk about, but I will at some point. In any case, what I found was that by giving these rats clean water and food, no pellets, the very food that I would eat. I would make extra juices and they would drink juice. All kinds of vegetable juices need all kinds of fruits and vegetables and grains. And by giving them a stress-free but stimulating environment, healthy food, they lived 20 to 25% longer than normal. And then 2 years later, I began to give them supplements. And the supplements that really stimulated additional lifespan included grapeseed extract. At that point, we had not discovered one of the most important nutrients found in grape seeds and grapes and grape skins, resveratrol. But the seeds were there, the skins were there, and the only reason I was using that because I had heard of the longevity of the wine growers who would eat grapes all day long and always had grapes. And when I went to Italy and I went to France, not in the cities, but certainly in the country, I couldn't go into a home that didn't have a giant bowl of fresh grapes always there. So I knew that there was something in those grapes that was doing a good job. So I would dehydrate at about 110 degrees the grapes and then blend up a whole blender full of grape seeds and grape skins, and I would feed them that all the time. Anyhow, I would add other things in like glutathione, alpha-lipoic acid later on. And about 10 years in, I was finding that these rats were living longer than any rats as I could find anywhere else. And that's how I developed many of the dietary programs to help people. And as the science of aging began to unfold, I began to see that it wasn't very complicated. But let me give you an example. Every morning, we would go to work out in the park, and I'd meet my friends there, and we'd do some training. And there was always a fella that would run on the bridle path around the reservoir. We wouldn't run on the bridle path. We'd run on the reservoir itself. He always ran at the same pace. He was just like a machine. He'd be clicking off 6-minute miles, and he would do 10 of them every single day. And I spoke to him, and we actually ran together many times. I said, why are you doing it? Are you racing? No. Are you training for any special event? No. I said, then why are you training 10 miles a day at 6-minute pace? He said, because I just feel great doing it. And one day I said, you realize you're prematurely aging your cells. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, every cell in the body except those that are reproduced, like in your gut, your skin, liver cells, these have a finite life. And each cell could divide and last maybe 2 years, 6 months, 2.5 years. But you're only going to have about 50 of these, more or less. So when that cell has reached the end of its capacity to divide, that cell line is, in effect, meets senescence, and it's no longer going to keep dividing. The telomeres have reached their end point. He didn't quite understand what I was saying. I said, you know something? You could do a lot of good if you only ran 4 miles a day at an 8-minute pace and do a little interval training. Do a 1 mile at 6, but then do the next mile at 9. Because that way you'll improve circulation to all the body, including the brain, You'll detoxify, you'll create stress hormone, de-stress hormones, and you'll keep a nice lean body weight, but you won't prematurely age. But then when you go home, you should take antioxidants because you've created free radicals, which is oxidative stress, and that will cause the body to prematurely age. So, he wouldn't do it. He didn't believe in it. Couldn't be true. He said, look, I read every medical magazine, and I read all the runners' magazines. I talked with some runners, and no one supports this. I said, okay. I said, look, Dennis, it's just, I'm trying to give you the benefit. If you want to come over to the lab, come over and watch the work I do. See how we can actually reverse aging. He never did. Skip ahead 10 years. I'm walking down to Lincoln Center in the summer. I like to go down there in the summertime because they have the swing dancing, and which is a lot of fun. In any case, there he is. Hadn't seen him. And he comes over to me and says, Gary, he says, man, it's been a long time. I said, yeah. He says, I should have listened. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, something that you said just made sense, but I just didn't want to break my habit. I guess I was addicted to this running thing. He said, my legs, my muscles are gone. I can't run a mile. I'm fatigued. I come down with infections. I've had all kinds of pains, and I had all kinds of tests done, and even though I'm only 40, they say that my biochemistry shows that my legs and body's closer to 60. He said, you were right. I just didn't want to believe it. Okay, that's one example. Let me give you a simpler example. Have some coffee. Have some sugar. Have some meat. Hot dog, hot hamburgers, pizzas, french fries. Eat more calories in this meal than what your body can use. Eat more protein in this meal than what your body can use. All of those will manifest the same outcome. You will start the process of prematurely aging your cells, which the part of the process that I didn't mention is that the cell, when it's being assaulted by toxins, pesticides, herbicides, chemicals, it will try to sacrifice itself. It becomes a suicide cell. It will sacrifice itself in order to preserve the next generation of cells. Let me try to be even clearer on this. When you do anything that is perceived at the cellular level as harmful to the cell has the capacity to speed up the aging process. In effect, it speeds up its own division faster than normal. Now, most science is not aware of this. In fact, I'll be making presentations at the next International Conference on Anti-Aging on these new phenomena of how cells can actually control the level to which they will speed up, because we thought it was fixed. It is not. And hence, it will sacrifice itself, showing you something about the integrity of the life force so that the next generation has a chance to live. So every time we do something stupid, even though we emotionally can handle it and ideologically have accepted it, the body doesn't. And that's why everyone I grew up with is sick or dead. Because they thought they were smarter than the choices they made. You're not. There's no human being that's ever lived in the history of the world that was ever smarter than a negative choice. It is ultimately the choice that wins the day. Sooner or later, all karma comes knocking. And so I'm suggesting if you want to live a longer life, we will have stem cell research that will help us. We will have rejuvenative therapies that will benefit us. And I'm talking about the next 2 or 3 or 4 years. By 5 years from now, we'll be able to probably physiologically knock 5 or 10 years off our physiological aging. But in the interim, every time you do something good, you're also sending a different message with a different energy, a vibration to the cell. Hence, you are lengthening the telomerase enzyme that's essential in creating the telomere, which impacting the telomere, which determines how long that particular organ will live, that cell will live. So when you have juices and good food and clean food, when you exercise, when you de-stress, and when you do good things that the body knows are in harmony with its own intent, then you're part of the anti-aging process. We all know that stem cell therapy has tremendous potential for the development of applications to repair and regenerate diseased, injured, and aging organs and tissues. We also know that while somatic cells in the body age and die, germline cells have been proliferating for billions of years. We know that shortening of telomeres is linked with cellular aging, and telomere length is related to the risk of numerous diseases. We know that germ cells possess an enzyme called telomerase that allows them to maintain the length of their telomeres and reproduce forever. Introducing the telomerase gene into somatic cells increases their longevity. We know that living by making healthier choices increases the length of lifespan of all the different cells. So, everything that I've been sharing over the years is a part of this. Now, what are some of the nutrients that we could be taking in that could help extend the life of the telomeres and hence the chromosomes? L-carnosine, 1 to 2,000 milligrams. Acetyl-L-carnitine, 1,000 milligrams. Acetyl-L-carnitine arginate, 700 milligrams. Alpha-lipoic acid, 200 to 600 milligrams. Benfetamine, 200 milligrams. B1, 50 milligrams. Rhodiola, 100 milligrams. Lutein, 10 milligrams. These are just some of the 30 different nutrients that can make a difference. The more raw food, living food, sprouts, juices you consume, you're putting time on your side. And that is a half hour on just one topic, because I felt that we needed to deal with that issue so people at least can understand this. Now, before we go to our guest, I'm very concerned that the American media is once again, as it has for so long, giving us only part of a story and intentionally not giving us the full story. And some of the commentators that I'm listening to on both MSNBC, NPR, and on Fox and networks, I don't even listen to networks anymore. They're so stupid, and the people on them are so stupid, and that it's just mind-numbing. You might as well take an ice pick in your brain as to watch network anything. But for those who think they're hip because of watching these other, let me share part of this story from Eric Dreister that you haven't heard before. You're looking, right? You're looking at the television. You're seeing violence on the streets of the Ukraine. But it's far more than an expression of popular anger. That's what we've been told, against a government. Instead, it is merely the latest example of the rise of the most insidious form of fascism that Europe has seen since the fall of the Third Reich. When we hear Bill O'Reilly being angry because we're not doing more, as if we should do something militarily, Bill, why aren't we doing more to the popular uprisings in, for example, in countries like Jordan or Saudi Arabia or Israel? I can name you 19 countries where there's popular revolt by citizens against the tyranny of the state, even when they have elections, and you haven't opened your mouth once on them. Recent months have seen regular protests by the Ukrainian political opposition and its supporters. Protest ostensibly in response to the Ukrainian president's refusal to sign a trade agreement with the European Union that was seen by many political observers as the first step towards European integration. The protests remained largely peaceful until January 17th, when protesters armed with clubs and helmets and improvised bombs unleashed brutal violence on the police, storming government buildings, beating anyone suspected pro-government sympathies, and generally wreaking havoc on the streets of Kiev. Now, did you hear anyone in the media ask, who are these people and what is their ideology? No. The political formation is known as Pravi Sektor, or Right Sektor, which is essentially an umbrella organization for a number of ultra-nationalist, meaning fascist, right-wing groups, including supporters of the Svoboda Freedom Party, Patriots of Ukraine Party, Ukrainian National Assembly, the Ukrainian National Self-Defense, and TRISBA. All of these organizations share a common ideology that is vehemently anti-Russian, anti-immigrant, and anti-Jewish, among other things. In addition, they share a common reverence for the so-called Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, led by Stepan Bandera, the infamous Nazi collaborators who actively fought against the Soviet Union and engaged in some of the worst atrocities committed by any side in World War II. And while Ukrainian political forces and opposition and government continue to negotiate, a very different battle is being waged in the streets. Using intimidation and brute force more typical of the brown shirts or Mussolini's black shirts than a contemporary political movement, these groups have managed to turn a conflict over economic policy and the political allegiances of the country into an existential struggle for the very survival of the nation that these so-called nationalists claim to love so dearly. So the images that we're seeing on the front page of the New York Times and on all the media of Kiev burning, in the streets filled with thugs, and other chilling examples of the chaos in the country illustrate beyond a shadow of a doubt that the political negotiation with the Maidan, which is Kiev's central square and center of the protests, opposition now no longer is the central issue. Rather, it is the question of Ukrainian fascism and whether it is to be supported or rejected. For its part, the United States has strongly come down on the side of the opposition, regardless of its political character. In fact, John McCain, Victoria Nuland were seen at Maidan lending their support to the protesters. However, remember, John McCain has supported everything. He supported the Iraq invasion. He supported the war in Afghanistan. He supports everything. If it's military and it's got a gun, a drone, he'll support it. But then again, almost everyone in Congress does, including Hillary Clinton. As the character of the opposition has become apparent in recent days, the U.S. and Western ruling class and the media machine have done little to condemn the fascist upsurge. Instead, their representatives have met with representatives of the right sector and deemed them to be no threat. In other words, the U.S. and its allies have given their tacit approval for the continuation and proliferation of the violence in the name of their ultimate goal, regime change. They did it in Libya. Want to go to Libya today and see what kind of great democracy we created? Yeah, and in Syria. We just can't get it right. In an attempt to pry Ukraine out of the Russian sphere of influence, the U.S., European Union, totally corrupt European Union, and NATO, which shouldn't exist at all, alliance has not for the first time allied itself with fascists. Of course, for decades, millions in Latin America were disappeared, murdered by fascist paramilitary forces armed and supported by the United States. The Mujahideen of Afghanistan, which later transmorphed into Al-Qaeda, also extreme ideological reactionaries, were created and financed by the United States for the purposes of destabilizing Russia. And of course, there is the painful reality of Libya and most recently Syria, where the United States and its allies finance and support extremist jihadists against a government that has refused to align with the United States and Israel. There is a disturbing pattern here that has never been lost on keen political observers. The United States always makes common cause with right-wing extremists and fascists for geopolitical gain. And we also did the same thing for 35 years with Mubarak in Egypt. Now, when the Egyptian military was imprisoning people, torturing people, when they were taking rendered people and torturing them to death, did we protest? No. When there was an initial effort in Tunisia, did we align with the protesters? No. It was all about waiting to see who would win, but supporting militarily the police. Even in apartheid South Africa, we, the United States, supported the apartheid regime in South Africa. We supported every fascist regime in South America and Central America against democratically elected governments or against populist movements, against trade unions, against land reform. We supported death squads. And yet no one's talking about this. We never get it right. We're incapable of getting this right. So the situation in the Ukraine is deeply troubling because it represents a political conflagration that would very easily tear the country apart less than 25 years after it gained independence from the Soviet Union. Ukraine and the rise of right-wing extremism there cannot be seen, let alone understood, in isolation. Rather, it must be examined as part of the growing trend throughout Europe. And that threatens the very foundations of democracy in Greece. Savage austerity imposed by the Troika, the International Monetary Fund, a corrupt organization, the European Central Bank, an evil organization, and the European Commission, worthless. All these are clown operations. The Three Stooges could do better than anyone I know in power in the world. I'm sickened by everyone. They're all sociopaths, and you know it, and I know it. You could have a lobotomy and be smarter than this president and more ethical by 10 measures. Well, what do you think happened when austerity, which we created, Goldman Sachs created, our Federal Reserve demanded, what do you think happened when you take the savings, the life support system away from a society and you say it's austerity? Why? We didn't create the problem. The banks did. The speculators did. Why shouldn't they eat their losses? No, we can't have that. That's not the way we work. We'll keep the profits, but you have to pay for the losses. So if you have to live on $700 a month, so be it. If the cost of living where you're living now is $1,200 a month, go dumpster diving. That's our message. It is against this backdrop of economic collapse that the Golden Dawn Party has grown to become the third most popular political party in the country. Espousing an ideology of hate, the Golden Dawn, in effect, a Nazi party that promotes anti-Jewish, anti-immigrant, anti-women chauvinism, is a political force that the government in Athens has understood to be a serious threat to the very fabric of society. It is this threat which led the government to arrest the party's leadership after the Golden Dawn Nazi fatality stabbed an anti-fascist rapper. Athens has launched an investigation in the party, though the results of this investigation and trial remain unclear. And what makes Golden Dawn such an insidious threat is the fact that despite their central ideology of Nazism, their anti-European, anti-austerity rhetoric appeals to many in the economically devastated Greece. As with many fascist movements in the 20th century, Golden Dawn scapegoats immigrants, Muslims, and African Americans, or Africans primarily, for many of the problems facing Greeks. In dire economic circumstances, such irrational hate becomes appealing, an answer to the question of how to solve society's problems, the Bill O'Reilly solving problem. And despite Golden Dawn's leaders being jailed, other party members are still in parliament, still running for major offices, including mayor of Athens. Were this phenomenon confined to Greece and Ukraine, it would not constitute a global trend. Sadly, however, we see the rise of similar, albeit slightly less overtly fascist, political parties all over Europe. In Spain, the ruling pro-austerity People's Party has moved to establish draconian laws restricting protests and free speech and empowering and sanctioning repulsive and repressive police tactics. In France, the National Front Party of Marine Le Pen, which vehemently scapegoats Muslims and African immigrants, won nearly 2% of the vote, 20% of the vote in the first round of the presidential elections. And similarly, the Party of Freedom in the Netherlands, which promotes anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant policies, has grown to be the third largest in parliament. And throughout Scandinavia, ultra-nationalist parties, which once toiled in the complete irrelevance and obscurity, are now significant players in elections. These trends are worrying. It should be noted that beyond Europe, there are a number of quasi-fascist political formations which are, in one way or another, supported by the United States. We can't find a right-wing organization that we can't find some way of funding or supporting overtly or covertly. And the right-wing coups that overthrew the governments of Paraguay and Honduras were tacitly and overtly supported by Washington in their seamless, endless quest to suppress the left in Latin America. And, of course, one should also remember that the protest movement in Russia was spearheaded by Alexei Navalny and his nationalist followers, who espouse a violently anti-Muslim racist ideology that views immigrants from the Russian Caucasus and the former Soviet republics as beneath European Russians. these and other examples begin to paint a very ugly portrait of a U.S. foreign policy that attempts to use economic hardships and political upheaval to extend our power grab. In the Ukraine, the right sector has taken the fight from the negotiating table to the streets in an attempt to fulfill the dream of Stefan Bandera, a Ukraine free of Russia, Jews, and all other undesirables as they see it. That is the part of the story that you're not seeing in the media. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. Day after day, I'm more confused. Nice to have you with us, everyone. On Monday evening, on the Progressive Commentary Hour at 7 o'clock, a full hour with one guest, Daniel Estulin, on transhumanism, the pros and cons of the new technologies to revolutionize humanity. You won't want to miss that. Ray McGovern on the government suppression of free speech. Cynthia Tayac, medical doctor on the prevention of cardiovascular disease. We have a whole lot of people next week. But right now, from Los Angeles, we have Annie Jacobson, a journalist, author, writes about war, weapons, U.S. national security, government secrecy, and military history. She is a former contributing editor for the Los Angeles Times magazine. Her first major book, which was a big bestseller, called Area 51, about the history of the U.S. secret military base in the Devaza Desert, became a bestseller. Her most recent book, just released this month, is Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America, which is the most thorough that I have looked at on the subject. She's a graduate of Princeton University, and her website is AnnieJacobson.com. Nice to have you this day, Annie.
Thank you for having me.
As I understand the internal dynamics and politics within the United States government and intelligence and military, turning Truman administration at the conclusion of the Second World War, there were those who felt soft about the Soviet Union and preferred to bring a thorough closure to Nazi regime with the Nuremberg trials as a testament that this would never happen again in world history. Then there were the hawks, which included the Dulles brothers, most notably Alan Dulles, who was the head of the OSS that later became the CIA. And he looked differently. He was very aggressive. He was a militarist, and he wanted to go after the Soviet Union. And this is one reason why scientists who were members of the Nazi Party and the more notorious departments such as the SS and the Gestapo would be held accountable, tried and would not be provided privileges as scientists work for the U.S. However, Operation Paperclip sidestepped Truman's concerns and, in fact, brought in many hardcore Nazi scientists and whitewashed their pasts and identities and then gave them lucrative government jobs. Many of them became extremely successful and lived like celebrities in certain American cities. Many of them, like von Braun, Kurt Dubus, Arthur Rudolph, and Strughold, were first classified as a menace to the security of the Allied forces, but then later were made into heroes. Tell us about how we created this and what part of this is of concern to you and should be concerned to us.
Operation Paperclip is a fascinating story about how, at the very end of the war, the U.S. government was faced with this decision of whether or not they were going to hire certain Nazi scientists or hang them at Nuremberg, as you mentioned. And as I examined these original documents about these decisions being made, the characters come to life and you really begin to see how certain parts of the Pentagon were really of the idea that we must get these scientists. It is the lesser of two evils. We must get them or the Soviets will. And then you see other generals who actually really liked these scientists, respected them, and even said so.
Hmm. Well, when we look at events of the past, the important issues for me are whether the legacy of that history continues to affect us today, and then what are the lessons of history that we need to be cognizant about as current events of corruption, injustice, human rights violations. I just mentioned that what the media in the United States is not telling us about the true nature of the conflict. Not that they're not legitimate people there fighting against their government, because they are right to do so, but we're not told about who's really controlling it. Who are the people really behind this? What is their motive? So we're never told the full truth. We had 90 million secret documents last year in the United States. This is from a president who promised us a new era of transparency. Yeah, well, we learned that wasn't true. So give us your best on this.
Well, you know, you're talking about such an important and heartfelt issue, because I think what you're really speaking to is, what does it mean when we hear that a program is being run in the name of national security? And some people may say to themselves, well, wait a minute, Operation Paperclip, this is a program from 1945. It started in 1945. It ran through the 60s. Why should I go back in time 69 years to learn anything about today? But I think you're speaking to a very important truth, and something that any concerned citizen can certainly learn from, because you see in this story, this classified history, now declassified history, of this early military program, you can see the machine making decisions, and you can see how the national security idea comes forth, that you've got a small group of people, in this case the Joint Chiefs of Staff were running Operation Paperclip, and they were saying among themselves and among a very small circular staff, this is what we must do, and therefore we will do it, and we will keep it from the American people. So Paperclip, remember, it was a classified program, but it had a benign public face. There was a few press releases, very softball press releases that said, you know, we're bringing over these German scientists, the good Germans, those that opposed Hitler, and they're going to be working on our programs. And that was, of course, very far from the truth in many of the instances that I recovered.
There's another part of this that concerns me. Over the years, there's been growing suspicion that some of our recent diseases have originated in laboratories devoted to biological warfare, and the relationship between the infamous Lab 257 on Plum Island off Long Island, where research was being conducted on ticks as a viable viral vector for delivering deadly diseases, and the appearance of Lyme disease has been very suspect. This was where Nazi scientist Eric Traub worked for a while. In fact, when the National Archive vaults of the USDA files were unearthed, there were two folders together, one labeled tick research and an empty one on Dr. Traub. And would you speak a bit more on the legacy of these Nazi researchers in research to weaponize pathogens and viruses, and how that has contributed to the U.S. biological warfare program and continues to this day, even though it's against the Geneva Convention? We're in violation of international law, but we still do it.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, you're really pointing out one of the very dark-hearted elements of Operation Paperclip, and that has to do with the biological warfare program, which goes back to the end of the war, when the Allies learned, and this is sort of in the fall of 1944, as the Allies are moving across the continent and the Reich is in ruins, but we haven't yet won. The Nazis have not yet surrendered. And our scientific intelligence teams learn about Hitler's biological weapons program. I write about this in Operation Paperclip, and it's really a dark and dramatic point of the story, because you have American intelligence agents on the search for Dr. Kurt Blomer, who is the head of the biological weapons research, and as you mentioned, his deputy, Dr. Eric Traub. And Traub was the person who had gone to Turkey on Himmler's orders. Heinrich Himmler was Reichsfuhrer SS, and he was really one of the leading proponents of the Reich's biological program. And he sent Traub to Turkey to get a sample of Rinderpest, because it was illegal all across Germany. It was a violation of the Geneva Convention, as you mentioned. And so the Reich wanted to weaponize Rinderpest as well. Now flash forward to our biological weapons programs. We absolutely know that Traub worked here in the United States. He was part of Operation Paperclip. Many of his files remain classified. What he did on Plum Island remains, in terms of my research, mysterious. I was able to gather some hard, cold facts about Traub's work, but others, as you say, is either classified or lost and missing. And that connection that is so important to so many people who have suffered from Lyme tick disease and really want that answer, could it have been a biological weapons experiment on Plum Island? Plum Island is, of course, that small island off the coast of Connecticut. You know, people saying, could this be have been a biological weapons experiment gone bad, where those ticks escaped on the backs of deers who may have been able to swim to the island? All very, very practical information there. But what we don't know is whether or not that connection can be made exactly. But I really hope that other journalists in the future are able to continue the research and learn that, because I found in writing Paperclip that for as many of these declassified files as I was able to get the Defense Department to declassify for me, hundreds, if not thousands, of more remain.
Well, look at Fritz Hoffman. We would never have known that he was directly connected with what later became Agent Orange. When we consider someone like Fritz Hoffman, who continued to work as one of the CIA's top chemists in the use of deadly chemicals for warfare and assassination, the question is whether any of the hardcore Nazi believers among these scientists were ever rehabilitated. And there have been books written showing the strong religious cultic elements that defined those who were most devoted to the messianic ideology of the Third Reich. And Peter Levendez's book, Unholy Alliance, comes immediately to mind, and religious fanatics are among the most difficult to rehabilitate, and they may suppress their true beliefs, but they rarely rehabilitate easily. And the Muslim prisoners in Guantanamo never gave up their deep faith in Islam, and the true believers in the Nazi cult were equally as devoted to their faith under worse conditions than any of the Nazi scientists ever faced. Your final comment, please.
Well, it's certainly a sordid and twisted tale when you're considering the backstory of any Nazi who was in the inner circle. And of the 21 Nazi scientists who I profile, a number of them had what was called favor from the Führer. They wore the golden party badge. And so you're talking about an ideology that is so odious and so profound. One really must ask, as you are asking, and I think it's important for listeners to ask, you know, can this kind of thinking, does this kind of thinking really end? If you're going to be involved in the Nazi Party, are you really going to change, or should you even have the opportunity to change your thinking? And that's why I think the central organizing question of Operation Paperclip is, was this a moral compromise? How could we have justified bringing any of these people who were so close to Hitler over to the United States in the name of national security?
I appreciate your good work, and I'm sure other people will use your work, which is meticulous, Annie, to go forward with this. AnnieJacobson.com is the website, Operation Paperclip, the book. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Gary Knoll. We're trying to bring you the issues that are not the focus of most programs, to let you see the world from a little different perspective. I will have a chance to talk about why do we fear the truth, and on our next program. Thank you very much for listening. Now let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. You know, one of the things I enjoy most about your audience are people that have known you for decades. And I do get some emails from them now and again, and I wanted to share one with you. This person doesn't identify him or herself, and this is what they say. They said, I've been listening to you for the last 2 years, and the person says, I remember you from 20 years ago, though I never met you. My family lived in Pilot Point, a few miles from your Healing Springs Ranch in Texas, and we would go to your place between Friday and Sunday and pretty much live there. We built a soccer field, a softball field, track, volleyball court. You had a swimming pool and you had a gym. And we never had any of that. And they said your brother Howard worked there with the mayor. He actually had people come there to stay out of trouble, to keep them busy. And then the person says on Friday and Saturday nights we hung out at the saloon there. where there was dancing. And you came down every August. And they said, I want to let you know that a lot of people appreciated your open-door hospitality. And your brother Howard was just one of a kind. So we never knew famous people who opened their houses to strangers. My mom even had bridge tournaments that went on Sundays. She said, I had some very fond memories, and it meant a lot to me on a personal level. And she just wanted to let you know that.
Well, that's nice. My brother called me once. My brother lived down there, Howard, and he called me once and says, Gary, I was just having lunch with the mayor here. It's a little tiny town, 247 people, and they don't have a gym, a YMCA. They don't have anything. Could they come on the weekend and use the property? Well, I had built a soccer field, a track, a volleyball court, a gym. There were two swimming pools, and I said, sure. And I built an old Wild West town. We had a saloon with memorabilia from Gene Autry, from the local neighbors who knew Gene Autry. People in their 80s and 90s brought saddles and all kinds of stuff, photographs. There was no alcohol, but it was a big dance floor. And I said, sure. What I didn't know was how popular it would become. So Pilot Point and Aubrey and all these places, hundreds of people come on the weekend and enjoy it. And that was fine with me. And they never made a mess. It was always cleaned up, Howard said, on Sunday evening. And I'm glad that they, well, I rarely hear anyone that many years later say thanks for something, but it's appreciated. I'm glad that they enjoyed themselves. I only went down once a year in August. So the rest of the year, I didn't have a chance to meet anyone. But glad that they enjoyed it. Thank you. Let's see.
Okay.
I'm got to run because I got to get over to our sister station and raise some money. Eutrice, your turn now. Go ahead.
Oh, well, today may be Friday, but for us it will be Tuesday because we're doing our open forum program today.
You know I can be found sitting home all alone. If you can't come around, at least please tell the phone. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. Baby, if I made you mad for something I might have said, please don't forget my past. The future looks bright ahead.